Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Mark E. Hauber. He's professor and executive director at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and we're talking about his new book, Bird Day, a story of 24 hours and 24 avian lives. Mark, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Now, this book is essentially, when you get down to it, it's about avian behavior. But it's set across the hours of a day. Describe how you came up with this concept.
I really wanted to say something about some of my favorite birds and some of the birds I didn't know anything about. And so this book represents a way of presenting it. You know, as birders and ornithologists and researchers, you wake up really early in the morning to watch your birds.
Oh, yeah.
As you know, but actually my birds do interesting things also in the afternoon. So like, you know, common cuckoos lay their eggs at 4 o'clock in the afternoon instead of early things in the morning because they need to avoid their host laying the eggs early in the morning. And so, you know, when you study brood parasites like I do, cowbirds and cuckoos, you end up spending your whole day watching bird behavior. And so I started thinking, like, what do birds do in the afternoon, or what do they do at noon? And I also had a research background in New Zealand, where you have kiwis and penguins that you know, are active at night. And so I started wondering, well, what do the birds do at night as well?
It's an amazing concept. So every hour of the day is a different species of bird, starting at midnight, going to 11 p.m. Now, I would find this very difficult for me. How did you come up with the short list of 24 species?
That was very difficult. I wanted to say things about birds that I personally study, so cowbirds and cuckoos and robins, and also birds that I had personal experiences. When I lived in New Zealand, I was part of a kiwi release exercise.
Oh, wow.
And so I got to hold a really dirty but you know, quite charismatic kiwi in my hand before it ran away as part of the release effort.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute, Mark. Did you get to see a kakapo?
I have seen kakapos, but I have seen them in somebody's basement. So what happens with kakapos is that if the parents are not good enough in raising the babies, or there's not enough food, the researchers pick up the babies and they hand raise them until they are ready for independence. And so that year was a bad year for the rimu fruit, which is what kakapos feed to their babies. And so all the young ones were taken into captivity and hand raised in someone's basement in Nelson, New Zealand. And I got to go and visit the babies in this person's
basement. Oh, man, Mark, that's like amazing.
That was amazing, I have to say. I actually had parrots at the time at home, and so I had to change my clothes and, you know, do a set of laundry, so make sure that I didn't infect them with anything cytosine.
Well, before we go any further, I want to talk about the illustrated. Can we say a few words about Tony?
Yeah, Tony Angel is just incredible. He's worked on owls, he's worked on other birds, and he just wanted little stories from me before I even wrote the chapters to do his illustrations, and then in vice versa, you know, when his illustrations were ready, I sort of, you know, wrote the chapters with that illustration in mind. So we really worked hand in hand to generate these pictures and also generate the stories that touch these illustrations.
I want to mention that the illustrations are done in pen and ink, and they're beautiful. They're really, really beautiful. But I also want to talk to you about the shape and size of the book, because it's unique. It's a small book with a lot of information in it, but it's square virtually almost.
Yeah, it was really exciting when I got to hold it for the first time. I've seen pictures of it, and so I couldn't quite get the dimensions, but it was, you know, sort of like, is it going to be thick? Is it going to be thin? You know, I wrote the book, you know, actually commuting on a train between Berlin and Amsterdam because there's nothing to watch, you know, outside. The landscape isn't that exciting, and it's an 8-hour train ride. And so, you know, I had these stories written up, and you know, the editor was working on it, and then we finally got the cover, and we finally got the shape of the book, and it was really a wholesome experience.
Back to this list, because I love this list. I would come up with a different list, but but there would be a lot of overlap. Were there species?
As you should, yeah.
Yeah. Were there species that you really wanted to put in, but you just couldn't do it?
Oh, absolutely. I mostly studied songbirds in my life, and so, you know, I have yellow warblers to talk about, and red-winged blackbirds to talk about, and prostonotary warblers to talk about. In New Zealand, I studied gray warblers, and we studied whiteheads and yellowheads, which are hosts to the cuckoos. And so there was a lot of birds that I didn't get to write about. I didn't write about, you know, things like the gannets that I had studied in New Zealand. I didn't write about, some of the other shorebirds that we had studied in New Zealand.
So is it possible that there'll be a second volume?
Well, I don't know if I want to do the same concept. We were thinking about writing a book about what birds do across the year, but following the same individual.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, we pick one species or maybe multiple species and describe, you know, what happens in the spring, what happens in the summer, what happens in the fall and the winter. And so, you know, maybe an annual, chronobiology paper or a book.
I think that's a good – I'm just putting my two cents right now. That's a great idea.
Thank you. But also the editor decided that he should do Frog Day and he should do Other Day books. And so University of Chicago is coming up with plans for other organisms doing the same things.
Well, let's talk about some of the species that you have in this book because they're great. The book starts at midnight and you picked a great bird for midnight, barn owl. Now, I have always thought this is amazing. And people may not know this, but barn owls can hunt in total darkness.
That's correct. They are one of the few species of birds that can just basically build a map of auditory information in their brain. And, you know, you might not know it, but in the laboratory, there are barn owl colonies where people study this. You know, I actually have met somebody who studied a barn owl and a half for his PhD because there's so much information to be learned from even a single individual that you can just keep asking the same owl. These are incredible birds that can pinpoint in three dimensions where the sound source is, and you know obviously that sound source should be a mouse, so they can just land and grab it. But they can work with wind noise. They can work with rustling leaf noise. They can locate different pitches of sound. So their brain is really designed for this flight in total darkness.
Here in Massachusetts, we're on the sort of the northern edge of their territory. They're found on like the islands off like Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket.
Oh, nice!
But they don't get into the inland because the winters are too harsh. They're because of their long bare legs. They seem to be succumbed to harsh winters easily.
I mean, having been to Massachusetts in the winter, I can't blame them. you can't have a snow cover for hunting in the middle of the winter.
Right.
So, you know, if the snow is sparse and you can hear the rodents rustling underneath, you know, then you can go and hunt for them.
Now you write that night rain is the enemy of the barn owl. Why?
Because it just disturbs the sound that the mice and the rats and the other rodents and shrews are making in the rustling leaves, and so you know the noise comes from everywhere. There's no directionality to it, and so the owl can't really orient itself.
Okay, 1 a.m. is the little spotted kiwi. Now I have yet to bird New Zealand, so I have yet to see a kiwi. That's one of my most wanted birds in the world. And there are several species of kiwis. People need to understand that. But they use smell to find their food. Talk about that.
Well, it's a nocturnal bird, right? You wanted to avoid the host eagle, which was this 10-kilogram, 20-pound eagle hunting for moas and other, ground birds in New Zealand. And so the kiwis evolved nocturnality, and they have this long beak to probe this, the soil, just like some shorebirds do. But their nostrils are at the top of the beak, and so they can, probe the soil and then sniff out the earthworms and other things they are picking up from the soil itself. Their eyes are tiny. Their visual system is tiny in the brain. We've actually done a study where we compared the skull shape of moas, which are extinct now, but which were diurnal. They had a big visual system. And then the skulls and the brains of the kiwis that we unfortunately got from roadkill kiwis, and they barely have a visual system to talk about.
Talk to me about the voices of kiwis. They use their voice to attract mates.
They do, and so the male and the females actually duet with each other.
Oh, wow.
And they work together. So, like the female lays this giant egg that, occupies, maybe half of her body cavity. And then it's the male who incubates the egg because she's exhausted, forming that egg. And so the male incubates the egg, and then the baby hatches and then just runs away. There's not much parental care happening in the system.
So they're precocial? The young kiwis are precocial?
Very much so, yeah. You can just hedge them in captivity, and they are ready to run around. And people do that because in New Zealand you've got stoats and rats and other introduced mammals. And unless you have a ferret, a 1 kilogram kiwi, so a 2 pound kiwi or 750 gram kiwi can make it against the stoats. It's not going to get killed by it. It can fight it off. So people raise in sanctuaries the kiwis up to this weight, that's sort of the magical weight, and then you can release them in nature and not worry about them dying from mammalian predation.
Can we just stop a minute for the benefit of the audience who doesn't know about the ecology of New Zealand? There were originally, I think, only bats found in New Zealand. How did all these other mammals get there? I know the answer, but I want you to talk about it.
Yeah, so the only land mammals in New Zealand were three species of bats. Two of them are really ancient, and then one sort of a more modern lineage. There's only two of them left, and that's a sad story, too. They were trying to save one of the species of native birds in New Zealand on an island that had this bat and then another species of bird, and they saved the focal target bird, which was the saddleback, but they lost the bat and they lost the bush wren, so don't even tell me about that.
Oh, God.
But most New Zealand mammals came to New Zealand via human trafficking. So the rat, the Pacific rat, the kiori in the Maori language was one of the first arrival. They also brought a dog that didn't quite make it. And then, when the Europeans arrived, they brought, two other species of rats and the house mouse. Actually all three subspecies of house mice exist in New Zealand. We've got a wild boar. We've got elk and deer. Somebody decided that kangaroos needed to live in New Zealand, so we've got wallabies, and possums. The bush-tailed possum, which is actually endangered in Australia, is in New Zealand for the fur trade and is doing really well, and of course eating bird eggs along the way.
It's amazing how Australasia got nailed by these introduction of mammals. Like Australia, people introduced rabbits to Australia,
yeah.
You can actually see films of how many rabbits there were in an area. I mean, it was a plague.
Yeah, it still is in New Zealand as well. So I worked on an island, Motuihe Island, and the rabbits had to be removed by trapping and shooting. There were feral cats on the island, and of course rats by poison drop. And the moment you did that, the New Zealand dotter owl, which is a plover type bird, raised its reproductive success about 300% from what it is in areas where there are rats still living.
Now, you talked about how large the kiwi egg is, and I've seen an x-ray of a kiwi egg still in the body. They never lay more than one, do they?
There are some kiwis that lay two eggs, but it does take, you know, several weeks to form that second egg.
Yeah, oh, my God.
Also, sitting on those two eggs is a big, big task for the male. So, you know, he gets exhausted just by incubating the. And these eggs need to be incubated for, you know, over a month. And so, you know, it takes a lot of effort on behalf of everybody to incubate and hatch a kiwi egg.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and researcher Mark E. Hauber. He's professor and executive director at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and we're talking about his new book. It's just a delight to read. There's a lot of information in there, too. Bird Day, a story of 24 hours and 24 avian lives. Now, 2 a.m., the oil bird. I've seen the oil bird, and I've seen it hunting at night. I went out on a night hike in Trinidad and actually got to see them picking fruit. Talk to me about the oil bird. They were extraordinary. They're very odd birds.
They really are, and it's one of the birds I did not see in my life, but I always wanted to know more about, and what way to learn about it is then write a book, or a book chapter at least. And so the oil birds are weird because, you know, they are the dolphins of the avian world, or the bats of the avian world, right? They echolocate by sound clicks. And so again, you know, when they are leaving the caves that they are they are nesting in, they are able not to hit the walls by echolocating and doing these clicking sounds. They're also, you know, because they are, you know, nocturnal and, you know, live in caves, they were used by humans extensively just harvesting the babies and using it for, you know, different sources of fatty substances.
I have to talk more about the poo. Poe, I fell in love with, what was the Buller's original book on the birds of New Zealand, and I fell in love with his plate of the owl parrot. These things are wild looking. They do look like owls if you cross an owl with a parrot, and they're mostly terrestrial, but they can fly, right?
Well, they flutter, right? And so, okay. You know, one of my former graduate students worked on the kakapo near Stewart Island on Codfish Island. And so, you know, these birds will like climb up, you know, a bush and then try to, you know, sort of launch into the air and use their vestigial wings to flutter. But, you know, they can end up on your head. And that's, you know, when it's a 4-pound bird, you know, that's not a, you know, an easy, you know, sort of task. Also, they have nice claws and everything, but they don't have powered flight. I'll tell you that, but they can flutter, and you know, for this large bird to do that is a big exercise. But mostly they just walk, and you know, they have to walk a lot because the males display on mountaintops and they dig a little bowl, you know, that sounds like an auditory chamber. Like, you know, sort of a negative parabola or something like that, and they boom and they attract the females, and the females listen, you know, at the bottom of the hill, and then decide, oh, you know, this guy, you know, so, Richard is the one I'm gonna go for. And then they have to climb up the mountain, walk up all the way, and then mate with that particular male. And then, you know, that's it. The male doesn't do anything else. The female, you know, chooses the burrow that she nests in. She incubates the eggs. She feeds the babies, and that's that.
So is it a lek?
It is an exploded lek, so you know they don't sit next to each other. They are sort of you know, a distance apart from each other. But it is, you know, a lacking mating system, and you know, the lucky guy gets a lot of females, and the others just wait all night long.
Now, there's so much interesting information I didn't know in your book. What happened when the female kakapos were artificially fed?
Well, that's the thing, you know, if you can provide resources for your offspring, you know, should you destine that offspring to be a male or a female. And Kakapo males are much larger than the females, so if you can raise a really fat and large chick, you know, then because you have lots of food resources, then you should destine that egg to be a male. And in birds, unlike in humans, you know, the female is the heterogametic sex, so she has a Z chromosome and then a W chromosome, and she can decide whether her egg is going to turn into a male or a female. And when you feed kakapos, they actually have more male destined eggs, which is great for the female because she's going to have this super successful male offspring, but not so great for the conservation biologists who want to have more eggs and the males are not laying eggs.
There's so many birds. Let's talk about brood parasites, because you do have the common cuckoo in this.
Of course.
And here, right here in Massachusetts, cowbird. We have the brown-headed cowbird, which is a nest parasite, but the behaviors of the two species are very, very different. The common cuckoo found in Europe is a rather large bird compared to its the species that it parasitizes.
That's right. And so the cuckoos have actually evolved much smaller eggs than they should be laying when they become parasitic. So cuckoos have become parasitic three times in their evolutionary history. The great spotted cuckoo is one lineage. The common cuckoo is one lineage. And then the pavonine cuckoo in South America is another lineage. But they all share this trait that their hosts are much smaller than themselves. And so their eggs are much smaller than predicted by their body size.
Now, they lay their egg in the nest of other species.
Does
the egg look very, very different from the host eggs?
So in the case of the cuckoos, they don't. The cuckoos are really good mimetic species. So they have host races. So a single cuckoo female will lay either always blue eggs or always beige and speckled eggs, but she will also preferentially parasitize blue egg-laying or beige speckled egg-laying hosts.
So that's all determined genetically?
It's all determined genetically, and we don't quite know where, what chromosome this color gene is on. We know for other species, such as cuckoo finches in Africa, that parasitize prenias, they actually have these color genes on their sex chromosome. But for the common cuckoos, we don't know yet.
Now, when the egg hatches, does the hatchling have sort of stereotypical motions where it throws the other young out of the nest?
Very much so. So common cuckoos do this. You know, you can actually press your finger against the back of a young cuckoo hatchling, and she will press back to you. You put some fake egg in there, she will toss it out. You hatch a nestmate, and she will toss it out. Cowbirds don't do that, right? Cowbirds grow up and sort of outcompete their host nestmates. But cuckoos eliminate the competition so that they can get a head start in life.
Doesn't the parent of the nest recognize the cuckoo as something radically different?
No, because the cuckoo chick bags intensively and it gets big. And so imagine an evolutionary scenario where you discriminate against your largest chick in the nest. That would be a total disaster, right? Because, you know, the largest chick is the one that's going to make it through migration, that's going to come back and establish a territory or lay lots of eggs. And so it's really difficult for a young a parent to evolve recognition of the cuckoo as the enemy, because alternatively would start rejecting its healthiest chick in the nest.
I've seen these photographs of the parent bird. I can't remember if it was a European warbler species or what. The cuckoo, the young cuckoo in the nest is literally so big that the parent species is still feeding it but standing on its head.
Yes. And you worry that it's going to swallow the parent, right?
Yeah, it doesn't.
I've seen those pictures too. And you know, what happens is, you know, think about the recognition system. You know, how would... chicks are really hard to recognize because they change from day to day, right? Like you can put on twice the weight that you had the day before. You start feathering out. You start, you know, showing color. And so it's really difficult to get a genetic recognition system for chicks because they change so much. So I think nature actually can't evolve a recognition system that rejects the cuckoo chick, but accepts the warbler chick itself.
Wow, we're almost out of time, and I want to talk at the end of these chapters. There's a really good message about climate change. Can we just say a couple of words about that?
Absolutely.
We shouldn't have to say a couple of words about it. But let's say it anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in North America, we lost, you know, over 30% of our bird species numbers. So, you know, even if a species didn't go extinct, the population sizes have declined by 30% or more.
I've noticed it in the field. It's amazing.
Yeah, and you notice that, you know, when you drive, you know, on the highway, the insects are not hitting your windows very much. And mm-hmm. So it's mostly the insectivorous birds that are losing out, nocturnal insectivorous birds, diurnal insectivorous birds, you know, they just don't have enough food to prey on. And the numbers are diminishing. And that's because of, you know, different elements of global change. Warming, you know, mismatches the time when you lay your own eggs versus when the food is available. Habitat change, habitat exploitation makes the land use different from what you need, and of course, you know, other anthropogenic effects such as insecticide usage, urban development, and even introduced species. You know, just because we live in North America, it doesn't mean that that we don't get introduced species that impact your habitat availability. Starlings and house sparrows are using holes and cavities that native birds should be using, and that's true in a lot of other continents too.
Right, locally, we've lost most of our nesting cliff swallows because of house sparrows. You see,
they are terrible predators of barn swallows and cliff swallows.
Oh,
exactly.
Yeah. Now we're almost out of time, but I got to ask you, as a person who's familiar with pronunciation of bird names, common, is it pochard or poachard?
I say pochard.
Okay, I say poacher too. For people who don't understand, it's a duck.
Yeah.
And we have poacher birds, ducks that belong in that family. Now we're talking the common poacher is a European species, but
you have redheads and canvasbacks, right?
That's right. And also, aren't most of the scop are considered poachers too?
Or as well, exactly.
And the behavior that you talk about of them in a flock with one eye open, you see that in every poachered species.
You do, yeah. And in fact, most ducks do it, you know.
Yep.
If you're floating on the surface, you know, and you're a great prey item for a hawk or, you know, a falcon, you know, you better keep one of your eyes open while the other half of your brain is asleep.
And people need to pick up your book and read about why that's how that happens. My guest tonight is writer and researcher Mark E. Hauber. He's also professor and executive director at the Graduate Center of the City of University of New York, and we've been talking about his new book. It's actually fun to read. Bird Day, a story of 24 hours and 24 avian lives. Mark, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.